Hello and welcome to the Woodard Report podcast, where we enrich businesses through business advisors. This podcast is your source for information and news you need for your accounting, bookkeeping, or tax practice, and it is proudly sponsored by RightWorks. For more information about RightWorks, please visit woodard.com/podcast. And now your hosts, Joe Woodard and Heather Satterley.
Well, hello, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us today on the Woodard Report podcast. And I am a little starstruck today and really excited to welcome our guest, Kelly Richmond Pope. So Kelly is an award-winning educator, researcher, and a documentary filmmaker, which is amazing. I can't wait to dig in to that with you, Kelly. You're the professor of accounting in the School of Accountancy and Management Information Systems at DePaul University in Chicago. And you focus on managerial and forensic accounting, which is, to me, like a super juicy topic. So welcome, and thank you so much for joining us today. It's such a treat.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah. So we were just talking about the weather. You have a beautiful sunny day. I have a stormy day. One of the things that I always think about is how lucky we are to be able to communicate with each other virtually. When I started in accounting, it's like we had to go everywhere. We had to drive. And if we couldn't drive, then we were stuck. So this is amazing. I'm not going to lie. I've been stalking you a little bit. And I'm a huge fan of what you're doing and what you're talking about and the passion that you have for, you know, forensic accounting and specifically fraud. I read your book, which was fantastic and such a great read. Such a fun read because you have all these incredible stories about fraud that I think everyone in accounting can relate to, that we've seen something where we've dealt with a client or within ourselves or within our team where we can recognize, wow, this is something I really need to be paying attention to. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you first, I love the story in your book, how you got started in accounting, and it really goes back to your dad. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So I started in accounting at a very early age. So I took my first accounting class in high school. And my father was a college president and a business school dean. So I grew up on a college campus and just academia, just feeling every, I guess I was born as a professor. But I knew that I appreciated and respected the field of accounting, and I knew how powerful it was. And so my father always encouraged me, this is what you should major in. It's a solid major. Everyone needs them. And at the time, my father was, like I said, the president or chancellor of North Carolina Central University. And I just always had followed his career and felt like I wanted to be the second Dr. Richmond. So my maiden name is Richmond. So I knew if I get my PhD, you know, one day dad and I could teach together or be at the same university. So that was an inspiration for me. As I got older and graduated from high school, he had an employee. When you're a chancellor, you have many employees. He had an employee that was indicted for an embezzlement situation with some government funds. And my father, of course, was not involved in what he did, but felt like we have to figure out this investigation first before we can fire him and do all these things. And so he really wanted to understand what happened. And so that really sparked my interest in a couple of things. One, what is this whole investigation? Because a lot of times when you think about investigation, you only think about it from the perspective of someone broke into your house or the police is trying to solve something that is a non-financial crime. But then it opened my eyes to this whole world of financial crime and financial investigations. It also opened my eyes up to the fact that good people, adults at the time, because I was in high school, but good people can make and rationalize bad decisions. So those two paths were opened up for me, and it really stuck with me and shaped me a lot. Another situation that happened to me when I was even younger than that is I was a Girl Scout. And I remember my mother made me sell my own Girl Scout cookies. She was not the person that took the Girl Scout sheet, cookie sheet to work and said, everybody sign it. No. Carol Ann Kelly Richmond, that was her name, was the person that said, oh, honey, you're going to sell these cookies on your own. So we would go around the neighborhood. I'd, you know, pitch my why you should buy cookies, get my orders. And then when the orders came, you know, I would go and deliver the cookies. So one day my mother came into the kitchen and noticed that I had a lot of snacks in my bag. And she said, where are you getting all this money from? And I said, oh, I just borrowed it from the Girl Scout money because I hadn't turned my money into my troop yet. And she said, honey, do you realize that is stealing? You are embezzling money. Like, that is not your money. And I said, well, Mom, I'm going to put it back. You know, what's the big deal? If I borrow $5, $20 and get a Twix or a Slurpee, like, what's the big deal? She's like, no, that's not yours. So even before the high school incident and just studying accounting in high school, I was a Girl Scout in like elementary and middle school. And that was really, I guess, when I think about it, was I an embezzler in the making? I don't know. But like that early story was my experience of understanding that, no, this isn't yours. Even if you put it back, even if you borrow it, it's not yours. And so those were the milestone moments that really shaped me. And I think a lot of us, if we think back to who we are as adults, they're really not far off from who we were as kids. And so those were when I was working on my book, I was being very self-reflective of how did I get here and why? And those stories really bubbled up to the top of my memories.
I love that. You know, one of the things that I really picked up in your book, you talk a lot about the people that, you know, the perps that that you're interviewing, and a lot of them you consider friends now. So the people that come and speak to your class, that you have interviewed, you know, for, you know, different things in your life, you consider their friends. They're people that you are, you know, that you are friends with. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that happened for me as I started exploring these fraud stories more is the perpetrators became human beings. And so when you read about fraud, you read about a case, evidence, but you sometimes what's left out is the human connection and the human emotion that is involved. And so what I've learned through the years is I do these on-camera interviews with people and you interact with them so much because, you know, it's the pre-interview, the interview, it's the post-interview, it's the follow-up. And then a lot of times we do speaking engagements around the country together. And what you learn is these are people that are defined by the worst mistake that they ever made. Now, what if everybody knew the worst mistake we all made? And we make mistakes all the time, just everybody doesn't know about them. And so that friendship or that connection really came from really understanding this person. Yes, they were a perpetrator and they broke this rule, but they're also a wife, a mother, a friend, an aunt. And so when you start doing these interviews with people and learning people's story, and I guess this is the power of storytelling, you recognize that they're human beings too. And yeah, they did something bad. They paid the price for it, but they're still human. So you get a lot closer to them than you probably would if you just read about them in the newspaper.
Yeah, no, my sister is a criminal defense attorney, and we've had lots of conversations about that because some of her clients who have done horrific, horrific crimes, you know, she has feelings for them because they're human beings. And again, you know, she says exactly the same thing. You can't define a person by the worst thing that they've done. And that's something that I think we forget when we're reading the headlines is that we put this label on people without realizing or acknowledging their humanity. And it's so important. You've been a victim of fraud yourself. Can you tell us about that?
Well, who hasn't, right? Like we all have. I mean, if you go into an audience and say, okay, who's been a victim before? Yeah. So I've had a lot of stories. I mean, from ticket sales scams to Airbnb scams, you name it. And you know, the reason why I was victimized is because I didn't pay attention to the red flags. Like, I didn't pay attention. And I know better. Even one of the IRS scams, I almost got caught up with that. And the two things. So not paying attention to the red flags and just being too busy. And it's like, you know, I'm doing five things at once, not paying attention. So I just hit send, or I just do the thing that they're asking me to do because they can, the perpetrator knows that I'm busy. So yeah, it even happens to me, or it used to. Now I'm just a lot more cautious about everything. Funny story. I did an interview yesterday with a journalist, a Huffington Post journalist or HuffPost journalist. And it was about phone scams. And she was asking, when someone says, "Can you hear me?" Should that be a trigger that it's a fraudulent call? And while we were having this interview, she kept saying, "Can you hear me? I'm having a problem with my connection." And so I sent her a text and I said, "You know, I don't trust you now, right? Because you're doing the exact same thing that your article is about. So now I think this whole thing is a scam. So if you don't call me back in like 5 seconds, this is over." You know, so like now you're just heightened because she was like, "Oh my God, it's not a scam." But I can totally understand why you would say that. So yeah, I've been a victim too. And when it happens, hopefully it's not too detrimental, but you should always leave those situations with some lessons learned. And my lessons learned have been not paying attention to the red flags or just being overly busy. I have an even funnier story than the reporter. I was teaching my class and I get a phone call, and I always have my cell phone with me because you just never know. And so it was right before class started. I get a phone call and it is from a person who says that they are a police officer. And they said, "May I speak with Kelly Pope?" And I said, "Yes, this is she." And he says, "This is Officer such and such. And we are outside of your house and your fire alarm is going off. And we've been called to turn it off. And we need to get into your house. And we noticed that you have a Ring alarm. So could you please just open the door? If you don't open the door, we're going to have to bust your door down because we need to make sure there's no fire inside."
Wow.
I said, "Sir, you must not know who you're talking to. The house can burn for all I care. You are going to first have to A, identify yourself, B, tell me a phone number that I can confirm who you are, and then we're going to have to roll back that whole story because what you just said sounds absolutely crazy. Like, I'm going to remotely let somebody in my home that tells me that." And so like, that's your radar should go up when you hear things, even that intensity, that scarcity of my house could burn down. Even that could have been enough to like, "Oh my goodness, of course I'm going to open the door." I said, "You know what? The most valuable things are outside of the house. The house burns, it burns. Insurance will cover it. Like, you're not going into my house." And so what was happening is there was some construction work going on at the time, and they triggered an alarm in the house, and they didn't realize that they did. So while I'm checking the police officer's credentials, I sent a text to the foreman on the job and said, "Please tell your guys in my house to open the door or they're going to bust my door down, and you're going to pay for a new door and a new door frame if that happens." You know, so you just have to settle when things feel like there's this urgency. You just have to settle because everything isn't urgent. You know, it's just not. So I was willing to let my house burn down.
Wow. Wow. So, you know, when we're talking about, you know, you're talking about house burning down, you're talking about, you know, you get these calls from the IRS. Really, when fraud comes down to from both ends, both for the perpetrator in many, many cases and for the person, the victim, right, is it's emotion, right? It's emotion that is causing all sides of this, right? And you talk about, you call whistleblowers heroes, right? And I was thinking about that. You say, you know, these whistleblowers are heroes, they're courageous, they step up and they're able to, you know, they're able to take a stand for what's right but you actually talk about the different types of whistleblowers. Can you talk a little bit about the different types of whistleblowers for our audience?
Sure.
I found that fascinating.
Well, one of the things that the reason why I wanted to provide three categories of whistleblowers, and those being accidental whistleblowers, noble whistleblowers, and vigilante whistleblowers, is because when you hear whistleblower, most people think snake, rat, tattletale, snake in the grass, you know, those are vigilante whistleblowers. And vigilante whistleblowers are the people that it might not have anything to do with them, but if it does, if it doesn't, and they know a rule is broken, they're going to say something and bring attention to it. And that's a good thing, right? You might not want your whole team full of vigilantes, but maybe one or two is a good thing. But there's these other two categories that many of us fall into that I wanted people to identify with the whistleblowing category in a different way. And so an accidental whistleblower is somebody that is head down, doing their work, and they notice something. And they notice something that just seems out of whack, and they report it. They didn't seek out to try to investigate something. They were doing their job. So in the normal course of what they normally do, and this can be very, this can happen to accountants all the time because we see things. You know, when we think about what a number is on a financial statement, it's a collection of stories and decisions. So we see things. And so if we saw something that just seemed odd, what are we going to do? We're going to say something, maybe not initially, but eventually. And so that is the accidental whistleblower. Now, the noble whistleblower is slightly different from the accidental, is the person that is on a team and everybody on the team knows the rules, but everybody decides they're going to break the rule for the sake of efficiency, for the sake of making the bottom line or getting to the number that you need to get. And this one person says, no, we're not doing that. We know what the rules are. We know we're breaking protocol, and they sort of speak up and say something. Those two profiles of whistleblowers get demonized and hated. And we need aspects of all three of those in our teams. We need to embody all three of those really within ourselves. But finding your whistleblowing voice can be tough because it is a scary landscape when you have to speak up, speak out against something that everybody else is either silent of or unaware of.
Absolutely. You know, I was thinking about that, and I was looking at, you know, when we were talking the whistleblower's hero, and I agree with you, they are heroes for sure. I did stop and question, okay, so a hero is a person who's admired, idealized for courage, outstanding achievements, or noble qualities. I stole that from the dictionary, right? And I'm thinking about it, and I'm like, these whistleblowers aren't always admired, right? If they are called a rat or whatever. And so I was like, what word would actually, you know, accurately describe that? And I was, martyr is what came to me, was that martyr from the dictionary is a person who sacrifices something for the sake of principle and doing what's right. And so that's really what ends up happening. And I've been in that situation. So my mother's a CPA, so we have that in common. Your father was an academic. My mother's a CPA, so I became a CPA. But I was working for her, and we had a client whose bookkeeper had moved, and he needed somebody to come in and take over the reins for the time being until he was able to hire someone else. And I went in and started reconciling the bank accounts and started seeing, you know, checks that didn't match the amount in the QuickBooks file and payroll checks that didn't exist and things like that. And before I knew it, I had uncovered about $45,000 in, you know, for our client, it's a lot of money. I mean, for me, that's a lot of money, but that's a lot of money.
For most people, and, that's a lot of money.
And I remember sitting there first not believing what I was seeing. And then it was like pulling that thread. Right? You're pulling the thread where you see one thing and then you start digging and all of a sudden you realize that the books were completely cooked. And I remember sitting there first having the, you know, feeling like I was going to, you know, be sick, right? Like, what do I do? Here I am in this office. That's not my office. It's somebody else's office. And, you know, I just uncovered this and I know that it's going to hurt the person who did it. And I know it's going to hurt the person that was the victim. And I know it's going to hurt my mom because she's the CPA and is going to have to deal with this. All these emotions started flooding in of like, I really went into a panic of like, I'm the person that just found this. And that is a very lonely and scary place to be. So having been in that situation, you know, I immediately was like, I'm going to lunch and went home and, you know, it was my mom. So I could say, Mom, oh my gosh, I think I just found this. What do I do? And she was able to coach me through it. But, you know, the client didn't prosecute. The client didn't prosecute.
Well, think about this. It costs money to do that, you know. Yeah. So when you are a victim, it costs money to find it, solve it, fight for it, fight for your, for what's right for you. It costs money. It's something unrelated. A friend said to me just last night who is going through a chemotherapy. She said, you know, it's expensive to be sick, you know, not only from just, you know, the medical bills, the fact that you need more care around the house, you're ordering more food because you're not cooking anymore, like all the things that come around it you sometimes don't think about. So when you're victimized, you think, yes, you have that loss, but then you have the loss of trying to litigate around it or the cost of litigation. So it's not surprising you think about when medium or small businesses get hit. Yeah, sometimes that only solution, and maybe not always the best solution, but sometimes the only solution is just remove person, and then we can just move on as business as usual. So I'm not surprised that they didn't do it. And I'm also not surprised that that sick feeling that you had, you know, how you responded to that. Thank goodness, though, you worked for your mom and you felt like you had her to go to support you and coach you. That's the missing link that a lot of whistleblowers don't have. I mean, they may not have that sponsor, that advocate, or even have the resources to hire an attorney if they feel like they need one. So all of these factors are reasons why whistleblowers tend to be silent. And when they do speak up, that's why they have to be our heroes, because they are taking on a significant amount of future stress in the name of good.
They are. And, you know, I mentioned at the very beginning when I introduced you that you produced a movie, All the Queen's Horses. By the way, I'm a horse woman. I love one horse, but love horses. So that was, you know, seeing the horses was a treat for me. But, you know, when you were interviewing, I'm trying to remember her name.
Kathy Swanson.
Yes. Thank you, Kathy. When you were interviewing Kathy, you could see it in her face, the pain that she went through. And she talked a lot about the 6 months of waiting for the FBI to actually charge Ruth, right? Or Rita, sorry, Rita, to charge Rita. And how difficult that was for her, and that she felt like she couldn't wait another minute. That was just so difficult for her. And I think that that's something we all have to understand, is that these whistleblowers, you're right, we think of them as rats, or, you know, oh, they're doing it for, you know, that there's no emotional connection and there's nothing that they're losing as a human. And there's so much that they're losing as a human.
Yeah. You think about the Rita and Kathy relationship. They worked together for 20 years. So just think about how much has been shared, how much either respect or admiration she might have had for Rita, she being Kathy, might have had for Rita. And so to know that this person that you've admired for so long is doing something so wrong and they're going to go to jail, and to know that and not be able to share that is a tremendous amount of stress. So yeah, there's loss on Kathy's side as well. Emotional loss. For sure.
And you could see it. You could see it in just the way that she spoke. And, you know, so I think that's really important. And I think that's something that, you know, as accountants, we're about the numbers, we're about crunching the numbers, and more we're dipping into these soft skills of understanding empathy, looking at the person. And I feel like that's something with the, you know, the whole CAS revolution of, you know, advisory services and stepping away from crunching the numbers, that's even more important. Would you agree with that? You, I, you know, you had done this really cool video about it, probably 6 months to a year ago, where you were talking about, you know, that new fledgling accountants aren't going into practice because accounting is just such a horrible for profession as far as our culture. Can you talk about that? Because I do think the humanity piece of that and those soft skills really plays into what you were talking about with that video. And I'm going to throw the link to that video because it's awesome into the speaker notes.
So I think what I strive to do in the classroom is to really remind students that that number is the end point, and what we're trying to unravel is everything that happened before, or we're either trying to opine on everything that happened before that led to that number. And I think far too often what we've done as a profession is just focused on the number. And we have forgotten about all the people and all the meetings and all the things that happened about that number. And so to attract people and keep people interested, you got to talk about the stuff that led to the number, because that's where the fun is. You know, that's where you get to know people. If you're just looking at the end point, that's not the journey, that's the end. And so I think the way we work now is so different. And I think our profession has stayed very traditional for a very long time. And Gen Zs are like, no, I don't want to work that way. I want work-life blend. They don't even want work-life balance. They want work-life blend. They want to be able to work a little bit, go to the coffee shop and do some work, maybe come back, maybe work from Seattle if you really live in Atlanta. Like, they want blend. And so historically, our profession hasn't been as welcoming to a blend environment. And then we have this thing called busy season. And when you tell somebody that you've got to work on Friday and Saturday for months on end, for maybe not significant pay, those things don't even make sense in today's environment with the way students think now about how work should complement. You know, I come from an era where you just did it, you know, like this is your job. If they say work a million hours, you work a million hours with a smile on your face. But they're like, no, you know, I want to work out. I want to have healthy foods. I want to take vacation every 2 months. Like, they have really shaped the way work is today. And I just don't think that our profession has moved as fast enough in the direction that our young people want. I think we're seeing changes, but they're just, you know, we never thought about the tech industry ever being what it is now in terms of working. You know, if you've ever gone out, and I'm sure you have gone to California, gone to the Valley, and see how people work and live. You know, there are on-site cleaners, on-site restaurants, on-site fitness, on-site yoga instructors. I mean, everything happens at the headquarter office. So it is catering to you being able to blend your work with your personal life. Our profession is very different than that, you know, so there's a disconnect there because you have this other industry that is showing a different way of working. And then you have these very traditional industries that are very, very different than that. And people are like, I want that over there. Like, I want to have a 15-minute break and go to a yoga class between client meetings. There's not a problem with that. You know, so you just think how we've evolved. Even the way we dress is different. You know, mm-hmm. depending on how old you are, you can remember a time when women couldn't wear pants to work. That wasn't that long ago. And now you can wear a sweatshirt to work. I mean, so like, there's just so many things that are pushing our younger accountants or younger future accountants away from the profession. And I think once we speed up to where times are now, they'll come back.
You know, and I think you're right. You're absolutely right. And I think what's happening is that there is a still small percentage of firms that have already recognized this, implemented it, and they have incredible teams, right? So, I mean, there's firms like Acuity, which, you know, they offer that work-life blend where, you know, they're working remote, but they also have, you know, a ping pong table in their office, right? We are seeing that needle move, and I think that we're going to see that move more, but you're right. In order to really turn around the issue that we're seeing here with these young people wanting to come into the profession, we're going to have to speed that up.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the things I've done in my classroom, as we are coming out of COVID or still having the effects of COVID, one of the things that I have been being more is intentional about being together. So if you are coming to class, we're going to engage in activities that you have to be here to. You have to physically be here and want to be here. I think work is similar, because if you know that there's a chef on site, there's yoga on site, there's a hairstylist on site, and then there's these really amazing like TED-like speakers that come every quarter, I want to be in that space. But if all I'm doing is plugging and chugging on a spreadsheet, I can definitely do that at home. So I think that when you are intentional about how people gather and spend their time together, they will come. But if you're not, if you just treat them like it's just a task, they won't come.
I couldn't agree more. And what you're talking about, you know, as far as making these changes, that takes boldness. That's going to take boldness of the leaders of our firms. It's going to take boldness of the Gen Zers that are coming in to be vocal about they want and about what they want and demand what they want to work, you know, to work how they would like to, you know, to see it. So it's going to be, change is hard. Change takes courage. And we all are going to have to step up to see it. It's coming. You can see it. And I think it looks amazing. So I'm excited to hear you talk at Scaling New Heights this June. Really, really excited. You're going to be doing a main stage presentation for us, and it's going to be a real treat. So Kelly, this has been fantastic. I could talk to you all day. And your stories have been amazing. I have one last question that I want to dig into, because I think everybody's dying to know. What was it that compelled you to actually step in and make a movie? You're a college professor, you're an accountant. What was it that compelled you to do that?
So as a professor, what we learn to do is do research. And what I wanted to do was to develop a project that had more scale and impact than a traditional research paper that's published in an academic journal that probably 10 people read. And so I wanted to do something that had impact, scale, but would cause people to be more self-reflective, not only about themselves, but about their environments that they work in. And I love TV and movies. I mean, that's just something that just as a pastime that I love. I'm always watching something, always, always. I mean, whether it's on Hulu, Apple TV, Netflix, you know it. I'm watching things because I really love story and I love to learn visually. So it just, doing the documentary really married a lot of just my personal passions and some of the goals that I wanted to meet as to have impact on the greater society.
Awesome. I love that. We think of accounting, or, you know, people think of accounting as just doing the number crunching, and that's, you know, that's who we are. I know so many accountants that step outside of that to embrace, you know, the arts. Like my friend Nancy McClellan, she's the dancing accountant. She's a dancer. You know, I have a friend Kathy, and she's an incredible artist. So I love that. And I love when you can combine those two things. You know, I teach, I love education like you do. And so being able to combine the teaching with the accounting is just such a blessing for me. So I love that. Now, I noticed in your book at the very end, when I was reading the epilogue, it kind of insinuated or kind of implied that maybe you were thinking about making another movie. Uh-huh. Did I read that wrong?
So I was in a movie called The Highest of Stakes. So at that point, I had just come back from Spain filming for this movie about this cryptocurrency that should be defunct at this point. But that is what I'm talking about. But I am in the process of making another documentary which is about, it's a medical healthcare fraud case. And so we're at the very beginning stages of it. And, you know, it's a powerful story, but I will tell you this. Independent filmmaking is rough in terms of fundraising, grant writing. I mean, now that I'm in the thick of applying for things, I'm asking myself, now, why am I doing this again? You know, because it is so hard. You know, it is just, it's so hard because you have, there once was a day when Netflix was not where the stars went. There once was a day, we can remember when streaming services were not winning Oscars and you know, Emmys and things like that. So even that space now has been crowded by Hollywood in a way. So that, so when you're independent, it's a hard road to travel down. So fingers crossed, Forget Me Not is the working title of the new documentary. Hopefully it gets done, but we'll see.
Well, I hope it gets done because all the Queen's Horses was fantastic. It was so well done. I really enjoyed it. So so I am totally rooting for you, Ellie.
And I thank you.
So thank you so much for spending time with me today. This has been fantastic. I can't wait to meet you in person in Orlando in June, and can't wait for your keynote. So thanks so much for joining us. Do you have any, you know, final words for our listeners?
Sure. I hope that you are never fooled. Hence the name, hint, hint, go get Fool Me Once, Scam Stories and Secrets from the $1 trillion Fraud Industry. And if you can, support your independent booksellers.
Oh, thank you so much. And we will put the links to Kelly's book in the speaker notes, so, or the listener notes. So please check out for that. And thanks again, Kelly. This has been awesome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. For more information, please visit woodard.com/podcast.